Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hey Andy, I'm just having a blast this Saturday afternoon.
Yes, we have been having a very interesting conversation leading up to now. Should we recap it for anybody?
I'm not sure if this is good for a family program.
Well,
We've got people all ages listening,
probably not all ages, but many of them. I don't
I
really
suspect
consider
we've
this
got
a
them from 18 to 70, or maybe even older than 70, maybe 80.
Yeah, well, it's not 8 to 80.
No, I said 18 to 80.
I know. I was just all ages. We probably don't have the 8-year-olds,
We probably don't have too many teenagers either, but
and we probably don't want the 8-year-olds.
I would think not.
Please consider making us part of your podcast diet. You can find us at Registry Matters on your smart speaker or podcast app of choice like Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts. Also, if you like what you hear, please write a review. If you don't, forget everything I just said. And before we get into anything, thank you to our new patron supporters, Ray and Michael A. Thank you for your support. Super duper awesome. And a super special thank you to Michael in Florida. Your pledge is fantastic. Thank you very much. Your support help keeps the show going. You too can support the podcast at patreon.com/registrymatters. Well, to kick things off, we got a couple voicemail messages. And the first one is from William.
Yes, my name is William, and I am a registered citizen in the state of Tennessee. And I wanted to know if you guys could address some of the issues that deal with sex offenders like myself who have completed their prison sentences but are still on lifetime supervision. And even though some of us are allowed to have the internet, we have to have a monitoring and filtering software package in place. And even after Packingham versus North Carolina, those of us who are on state supervision are told that that ruling does not apply to us, that we are still banished from social media without regard to whether or not we ever use social media to commit our offenses. And also, I want to talk about the required polygraphs that lifetime supervision registrants in Tennessee are subjected to. Have a great day.
It's a really good question, and he brings up some interesting points. What do you think?
That was a lot. I was trying to take notes because it was so such a question. The polygraph, I think I'd like to do the supervision for life. I have heard from a number of people in Tennessee that they're subject to this supervision for life regime, and Tennessee's not the only state. New Jersey, there are others who I'm aware of that they don't call it. It's not actual parole. They call it community supervision. I think New Jersey calls it CSL, community supervision for life. But it's essentially the same thing. As the caller, William described, they pretty much have the same restrictions if you were on your regular standard parole supervision. I've talked to one attorney in Tennessee, and he was not terribly optimistic that challenging that would gain a lot of traction. But we don't give up with one attorney. We continue to explore what can be done in view of the shifting judicial landscape. But punishment is something that the legislatures cannot fix. And the only constitutional prohibition is that if it is cruel and unusual. And I don't know if William has heard me before, but when I talk about cruel and unusual punishment is generally interpreted as, if you take the conservative view, that's the constitutional framers. We take it literally as the words were understood at the time. And cruel and unusual punishment was something really horrendous. The death penalty even was not considered cruel and unusual in colonial times. It was quite widely accepted.
Sure, being in the stockade and having poo thrown at you in the city square, that probably wasn't considered cruel and unusual either.
It might have been, but it took a lot to rise to the level of cruel and unusual. It had to be something that's very torturous and inhumane. And the liberal progressive view is that we have evolving standards of decency, and as society evolves, the standards evolve, and what we would have accepted, we will no longer accept. But you have a tug of war right now between the conservatives and the liberals. There are more and more conservatives being seated on the Supreme Court and on the appellate level courts, and even on the trial level courts at the federal level, because the last 2 years of the Obama presidency, the Republicans controlled the Senate, and therefore they did not confirm very many federal judges. I don't want to say they didn't confirm any, because I don't know if I could validate that, but they confirmed very few, if any. And for the appellate courts, they all but stopped confirming judges, which means that the Trump administration has got more than 100 benches to fill, 100 judicial vacancies, and they've been filling them at breakneck pace because they're concerned that they might lose control of the Senate in 2018, which would mean that they would no longer be able to railroad their confirmations through. Bottom line is, in the conservative judicial climate, it's going to be tough to get to where he wants to go through litigation. If the legislature and good citizens of Tennessee have decided they want to supervise people for life and they're willing to fund that, a judicial remedy may be beyond our reach. And that's not me saying I agree with it, but it's a policy decision, and the courts don't exist to decide public policy. It depends on how much the people of Tennessee are willing to spend to supervise what size population for the remainder of their life. And when they decide they've had enough, just like with prison, well, how many people are incarcerating, some states are deciding that they've reached a tipping point where they need to find alternatives. But I'm just not overly optimistic that the courts are going to be able to resolve that, and that's what our attorney has told us in Tennessee.
And to loop back around to the Senate, where Mitch McConnell has said that it is like his objective to fill as many of those seats as he can in the time that they have. I mean, to get all of them filled with the most conservative justices that they can find.
That is correct. And that is his prerogative to try to do that. Now, he's breaking all sorts of traditions in terms of the judge that's appointed from a particular state to serve. If either senator objected, the right. Tradition has that person didn't go forward. But McConnell has decided that's a tradition to jettison. We're in some peculiar times in terms of long-term precedents have been broken. The Merrick Garland nomination was stalled for almost a complete year.
Yep.
By Mitch McConnell, saying that it was his prerogative to do that, and he was rewarded by continued control of the Senate. So apparently the people have no objection to that being done, but it's unprecedented to have a president not even have his nominee considered. They could have declined to confirm the person, but they didn't even bother to help him, right, to give Judge Garland any consideration. In terms of the social media, there I'm more optimistic for William that something can be done about that. But you got to read the Supreme Court decision in Packingham with some caution. They didn't say that everybody has an unlimited right to use social media. They said they were particularly appalled by people who had that were having these restrictions who had paid their debt in full.
Right.
So I would guess that the Tennessee Department of Corrections has taken that dicta and said, well, the Supreme Court clearly carved out an exception for us to do what we want. I don't read it that way. I read that the Supreme Court was appalled by North Carolina trying to apply it to everybody, but they expressed great trepidation about a blanket ban for everyone, which is apparently what Tennessee and other states are doing. And if it is, in fact, a blanket ban without any regard to the individual determination, an individual determination or analysis, I think there might be something that could be done there, because that would a blanket ban has no merit to say that we just pronounce the fact that you're required to have a registration obligation, therefore you're banned from social media while you're under supervision. I think that would be problematic by the courts. Or if they argued Packingham, took that to federal court, I think there's a good chance that they would gain some traction on that issue.
And as with nearly all of these things, though, you have to have someone with skin in the game, someone with, that says, hey, I'm going to do this thing, and then get in trouble for it before it can, or you have to find someone that is being harmed, maybe like a business owner that's trying to use social media for their business and they can't, so they are able to bring litigation because they're being harmed by that.
You would need someone with standing, and I would argue that anybody who's under supervision would have the requisite standing. But then you've got to convince a law firm that this case is powerful enough. Very few people have the resources to fund these challenges themselves. The advocacy groups are very, very sparsely funded. They don't have gobs of money, which means that you're looking to do this on a recovery at the end as a prevailing party in a federal civil rights action. And an attorney that's got a say it's a solo practitioner, then you're really up the wall, because fighting the government, they can wear you down with lots of paper, as we call it. They can paper you to death.
Yeah.
And a solo practitioner, when he comes home, he's got his family saying, why are you spending all this time on this thing? Well, it's a matter of principle. But we can't pay our mortgage. Well, it's a matter of principle, by golly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do it. And so you have to get into a larger firm if you're going to have more than one attorney, where they can possibly have hope of carrying this to its conclusion, because the state will fight tooth and nail to preserve what they're doing. And they have almost limitless resources. And that creates the problem for us, because William probably has even spoken to an attorney, I would guess, and the attorney have been lukewarm, because they're going to be up against a state bureaucracy that's well-funded, the Attorney General of Tennessee, and they're not anxious to take on that and not be able to get paid for maybe years, if at all.
But you do feel optimistic that that is, and then there, on the heels of that, there's the West Virginia decision that was not roughly similar, but at least in the same ballpark about restricting internet access, that they can't just do it. But I guess his question is more about being monitored about the usage that he is doing it.
Well, he said that when his message said that they explicitly said Packingham doesn't apply, and that they can still forbid him from it. That's the way I understood his message.
Okay.
And Packingham does apply. The U.S. Supreme Court, their decisions are the law of the land.
Right.
But Packingham was addressing a person who had paid their debt to society.
Right.
Their concern about the blanket prohibition, that there's a good chance that the lower courts would interpret the same way. Was that Virginia or West Virginia? I think it was West Virginia.
That was West Virginia with the second one.
I think that there's a good chance for William, which means that the people in Tennessee, our registered citizens in Tennessee, it would behoove them to come together and try to muster some financial resources and maybe contact DARSL and see if we can come up with some matching funds to undertake this action. We don't have the resources to go in and fund things, but we can sometimes help with fundraising, and we can help facilitate a good cause of action. But it requires that the offender population also put a little skin in the game.
Right.
And that's been where we've been failing on getting a lot of offenders to recognize the benefit. The attitude is, if I can't personally benefit, I'm not going to contribute to a cause that doesn't personally benefit me.
It's funny that you bring that up. I was having a conversation with someone on Twitter, and I was trying to rally the troops about, you know, we have to, I guess I was using a logical fallacy or cognitive bias. It's the bystander effect, where you're just sitting there waiting for someone else to make some sort of action. And the more people that you see in the room, the less likelihood there is anybody that's going to do it, because you're always sitting there going, well, he'll probably do it, or she'll do it, or somebody else will do it. Why does it have to be me? If you arrive on the crash scene and there's no one around, well, no one can do it but me. I'm the only one here. And my point is that we are the ones that are standing there in the room with everyone else looking on the sidelines, waiting for someone else to do it. But the person was pushing back, saying, why can't we hire attorneys? Why can't we get these national organizations to step in and help us? And it's because it's expensive and we don't fund it.
The national organizations, if you put the three prominent national organizations combined, we could only make a small dent in the iceberg of things that are to be challenged and needing to be challenged, that are good, viable challenges that go undone because of lack of funding. But his last point, at least the way I wrote it down, was regarding polygraphs. Again, there is a Fifth Amendment absolute right that's in our Constitution not to incriminate oneself. And we've talked about that, I think, at least on a couple of podcasts.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about that before. And the question becomes, what do you do about it? And there's a case out of the Tenth Circuit, U.S. versus Von Behring.
Colorado.
And that case, that case gives some guidance in terms of the law of the Tenth Circuit about there has to be a bona fide threat of prosecution if you answer those particular questions. And people, when they saw Von Behring, they jumped to the conclusion that it said you didn't have to take a polygraph. That is not what they said. They said that you could decline to answer questions where there was a clear threat of incrimination that would potentially result in prosecution.
But you can't not answer a question like, what is your name? What is your address? Where are you employed? Are you here with me today? You have to answer those. But when they ask right. you, did you do something bad with that little kid down the street, whatever you did, you can then plead the Fifth.
Well, if it's related to the charge you're under supervision for, you've already been adjudicated for that, so there would be no threat of prosecution.
Okay.
Of that particular, but undetected in Von Behring, the issue was undetected criminality, and without immunity, the person was risking additional prosecution. What was less clear in the Von Behring decision is a violation of supervision terms. Is that sufficient for you to invoke the Fifth as well? Because you've already been adjudicated for the offense that's requiring the supervision of the polygraph. And if they ask you, have you violated curfew or any of your technical conditions, and you shall refuse to answer that, Von Behring doesn't give us much guidance on that.
Right.
In terms of whether I mean, clearly, if they file a petition to revoke, you're facing jeopardy, but you've already been adjudicated on that offense. So I'm hesitant to tell people that they can decline to answer. I would encourage everyone to talk to an attorney about this particular, someone that knows a little bit about the Fifth Amendment, but they could certainly provide the attorney with the Von Behring case, the citation to that case, and they could review it and see exactly how far that you might push this issue. But don't decline to take their test. That is not a wise move. If you say I'm just not going to take your test, that's not going to end well for you. I think we've got a history of that in the state of Georgia that we can talk about.
What about the financial side of it, where these things typically cost you $1, you know, $2.25 or $2.50 for a polygraph that comes out of your pocket?
I'm concerned about that as well. Clearly, the legislatures don't want the good taxpayers to have to pay for that. But when you combine all these oppressive costs, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's the treatment.
Yeah.
There's the supervision costs. That the person's assigned those costs are all taxed against the supervised person, and those things can be enormous. I've heard varying figures, but it can be many hundreds of dollars a month for supervision and court costs. And then particularly the South, but even outside the South, there are states who really rack up fees on a conviction. When you look at, I saw a judgment a couple years ago out of Pennsylvania, and I thought my state was bad. And my state is very mild compared to what I saw in Pennsylvania. But when they have all these fees that they tack on to your conviction, you're talking about a significant financial obligation. And there again, from a constitutional perspective, could you argue it's cruel and unusual punishment? You could argue it.
But does anybody care?
I'm not sure that you're going to gain any traction with arguing that. Those are public policy decisions. And then what do they do if you don't pay those costs? If you don't pay the $250, I have not seen anyone, and this is not me saying it's not happening, no one has shown me a petition to revoke supervision where it says offender unable to pay polygraph costs, therefore we're moving to revoke. If anybody has one of those, I'd like to see it.
I can only tell you an anecdotal about a friend of mine that was unable to pay. The treatment provider said she would remove him from treatment. That would be a breach of his probation, and that would violate him. Now, he went out and title pawned his car, which is ridiculous, but that's where it went. And his PO gave him a one month extension before he had to do it. But he turned around and did it and title pawned his car.
And that's the treatment provider going to drop him from treatment. And if he's dropped from treatment because he can't afford it, there again, I'd like to see how they carefully craft the petition. If you're refusing to participate in treatment, that's one thing.
Right.
If you can't afford treatment, that's quite another. So it'd be interesting if I were on the defense side of that, I would go in and fight that on the merits and say, well, it's not that he's not cooperating with treatment, it's that he can't afford all the costs associated with treatment.
Yeah, this
he's
is
paying what he can.
This guy was making $8-9 an hour, something like that, and then paying 23% in child support, then also tacking on the polygraph stuff on top. He was like, I have to eat ramen soups because I can only afford 35 cents for dinner.
But if there are examples out there in our listening audience where it clearly says petition revoke, basis for revocation, could not pay for polygraph, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see the one that says failed polygraph. No one has been able to produce either one of those examples for me.
Are you challenging someone to step up and do it?
I'm asking someone to step up and do it because it helps us to build a possible cause of action.
Right.
It's one thing if they tell you you show deception on a polygraph and you confess, which is what people always do.
Right.
They tell them that, well, yeah, I did skip curfew. Yes, I did watch porn. I went to the strip show or whatever. But I have not seen a petition revoked that says basis for revocation, show deception on polygraph, end of request. I have seen them where they said basis for revocation was that after a periodic maintenance polygraph test, offender admitted X, Y, and Z. I've seen several of those, but not one where it just said a show of deception, and therefore we've moved to revoke. And I'm hoping that someone can show me one because I have to see it to know how to proceed. Then we may have a cause of action here because the polygraph alone, I don't believe is going to be sufficient. And if someone got revoked merely on that evidence without anything else, I'd like to know about it.
So here's a voicemail from Buzz.
Buzz Aldrin?
No, not that Buzz. It would be a different one.
Hi, yes, my name is Buzz, and I listen to your podcast religiously. I enjoyed episode 25 a great deal. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. One of the things that you and Larry frequently talk about is how the government is just responding to what the people want. One of the things that I learned in school is that the reason we have a republic and not a democracy is that the representatives are supposed to be smart enough not to succumb to mob rule. In other words, if we just had a democracy, we would have kind of a majority rule on everything and no minority rights. In other words, the reason for a republic is so that you enjoy having representatives that generally represent the people, but that are smart enough to also understand the rights of the minority and not just succumb to mob rule.
So let's stop there for just a second, because that's what happened in California with the judge, right?
That is correct. And I agree with Buzz on everything he said just now. He's absolutely right. The only problem is a lot of our processes have been hijacked. And that's that. I forget which founder said we've got a republic if we can keep it. That was a quote. We're gradually letting the beautiful system we have be taken away from us. And but he's right. I mean, like the filibuster rule. That filibuster rule was designed for a reason. That's to take the most deliberative body in the United States government, the U.S. Senate, which only has to face the wrath of the voters every 6 years, and to make sure that things that are radical changes required more than just a simple majority. That's an example of that. The Electoral College is another example of that, to make sure that we don't have a president simply just catering to those who live in urban areas without any regard to the rural America. There's so many things that were designed to make sure that the rights of the minority were protected, but we're getting away from that because it's inconvenient. Our government is inconvenient for a lot of people, that they find it to be problematic that they're not able to get what they want, and we're willing to give up a lot of things. For example, national security. We're willing to give up a lot of rights to feel safe, and that's dangerous.
That quote was from Benjamin Franklin.
And could you get a bit more succinctly than what I did? Because I kind of messed it up.
No, you had it. It was what do we have, a republic or a monarchy? And he responds, we have a republic if you can keep it, or if we can keep it.
Yep. Yes. And he had great concerns that we would not be able to keep it.
Well, here we are 200 and whatever, 50 years later, and it's a struggle.
So that's one point I had. The other point I had is I like how you've cleaned up your language. I used to be a professional myself. I used to be an electrical engineer with I used to work for Cisco. I had a CCIE.
Just as a point of reference, that CCIE is almost like a PhD of networking stuff, and they are paid very high wages.
I used to make well over six figures, and now I'm struggling to try to find a minimum wage job. I'm taking some welding classes because I had heard that maybe welding is a way to get in to somewhere small enough that'll take you without worrying so much about the registry. The third thing I had is that it would be great if you could offer some hints to registrants on how to live life in a more productive way on every episode, because I think that's one thing that's missing. There's a lot of kind of, you know, whining about or talking about different issues, but if we could also add a segment, like, for example, one of the registrants I talked to told me a neat trick for finding a job is to use the registry against them, is to go to the registry, look at the people on the registry in your area, look at their work address, do a reverse Google search on the work address and find out where it is. And then that way you've already found some places that'll hire registrants. So maybe if we use that against them, they'll realize that and they'll say, hey, we'll take the work addresses off, which would help me a lot because two companies wouldn't hire me just because of that. Anyway, I like your show. Thank you.
I tried to do something similar, but not all states post work addresses on the registry.
I would say I agree again with what William has said, and I'm going to give a shout out to my friend Don and Alice with Titus House here in New Mexico. They work with reentering sex offenders from prison, and Don spent hours doing that very thing, going through the registry and compiling every employer that was listed.
Wow, that's huge.
And then we ran into a new problem, is trying to figure out how to utilize it without hurting the very people we're trying to help.
Right.
The employers are already taking grief about having their information on the registry, and Texas was able, with assistance of the business community, to get that information off the website. But how do we make that available to help the offenders without hurting them? Because unless we have a closed list, which is essentially where we have the information, we were afraid that having the information readily available was going to cause the employers to be ridiculed for hiring former sexual offenders, and then we were going to cause more harm than good. But I agree with William. We would like to help people reintegrate with any type of assistance, and knowing how to find a job is a big part of the requirements, because you have to be gainfully employed to do any of this stuff.
Mostly, yes. So out of the thousands of people that listen to the show, if you have any tips, email them, Twitter, voicemail, feel free. We will distribute them and pass out all the ones that we can come up with. The two of us have been in the game. You significantly longer than me, that you probably have a lot more little tips and tricks. Actually, let me throw this one out there. There's an app. I think it's only on Android. This came out in the new magazine, and I'm going to try and remember the name while I think about this. But the app on the phone is called CSZ Free. So Charlie Sierra November Free. And that will overlay 1,000-foot or 2,500-foot circles over addresses that you type in to let you, and it will tell you where there are churches, schools, daycares, things of that nature in that area that might prevent you from working or living at an address. CSZ Free. Child Safety Zone Free is what it is.
I have never heard of that app, Andy.
It's I only learned of it with that first the initial issue of that magazine that Will puts out. Help me remember the name. I covered it on episode 10 or something on the podcast.
Lifetime.
I got it from there, and so go over and check out Lifetime magazine. And like I said, the first episode, they've only done two episodes, but it was in the first one that I learned of it. It's kind of a neat, it's ads. So that the guy that wrote it is trying to do ad supported stuff. So, you know, click on ads to help the guy make a couple bucks, but otherwise the app is free and it's kind of neat to look up addresses and it draws the circles for you. But to go with that information from Buzz about earning very high wages to then barely being able to make it, I was listening to a financial podcast this weekend, or this week, called The Phil Ferguson Show, hosted by a guy that you'll never guess. His name's Phil Ferguson. And he had an expert on Social Security on there. And while I feel like I'm pretty knowledgeable about Social Security, and I'm sure you have your information covered, Larry, the one thing that I didn't know exactly is how do they calculate how much you're going to get? And they use the 35 years of your highest earnings, average that together, and that's what your rate comes out to be. And but so you have, I don't know, like 50 years of working time from the time that you're a teen and you start doing your first job to the time that you're in your 60s or 70s before you stop. But if you spend 10 or 20 years behind bars, those are all going to be a bunch of zeros. And those zeros are going to horrendously impact the amount that you're going to collect in Social Security. So not only did you lose your family and your job and your life savings and all that stuff when you went to prison, you also had all those years that you weren't earning any money, you know, possibly planning for retirement and saving. Then when it does come time for you to retire, you're going to likely get less money because you have put in less money into Social Security. And I just thought that, hey, let's just top this whole thing off and screw you over in the end. Yes, you did your crime or you pled out. I get it. But it's a rough situation. End up when you're 65 and you're going to get, you know, I don't know, $500 or $1,000 less than you possibly would have had you kept earning the higher income.
Well, let's just break it down for folks. If you had you only have to have 10 years of earnings to be eligible for Social Security retirement, which is 4 credits per year you can earn. It used to be 4 quarters, but 4 credits. So you need 40. And say you earn $40,000 a year for 10 years and you got $400,000 and you average that, you average it over 35 because they average, it doesn't matter. You only work 10 years. They average it by 35.
Yep.
You've got an annual earnings of $14,000, which will base your benefits. If you had earned $40,000 for the entire 35 years, then you can see your benefit would be a whole lot better. You want to keep as many zeros out of the equation as you possibly can.
Yep.
The only time the zeros don't hurt you is if you're in a period of disability. They don't give you zeros during that period of time.
Hmm.
But most people are not determined to be disabled while they're in prison. That doesn't constitute a disability. Right. It has to be a physical or mental disability impairment. But yeah, your average benefit would your average earnings would be very low if you had a large period of incarceration, particularly if you were a moderate wage earner to start with.
And so if you want to find out how much you're going to earn, go to ssa.gov/myaccount, and you can sign up there easy, free. They ask you a couple questions to confirm your identity, and you can see how much you will earn at retirement or, you know, 65, whatever. And so I just wanted to pass that along because that 35-year average thing was something that was new to me, and I wanted to push out because those years in prison could really, really F you up on the backside when you start drawing Social Security.
Well, 1 zero is not going to hurt you too bad, but a whole lot of them would be detrimental.
Well, then, so the first article is from the Herald Sun. Durham police investigate sexting report at high school. The reason I wanted to bring this up is twofold. 27% of teens report sending a text, but only 15% report receiving one. There's a disparity in there of a, you know, 12-ish percent of people saying that they sent them, and so did they send them nowhere? I'm kidding, of course. But people are just not reporting receiving a sext message. But more importantly, the article says that there are no specific laws in North Carolina dealing with sexting. The behavior is punished by more severe penalties. It brings up the situation where two teens were sending nude photos of each other, and the male was being charged as an adult for distributing CP, but the CP was of himself. And I just can't quite wrap my head around how you are charged as distributing child porn when it is you distributing yourself and you're being charged as an adult for that activity. That just hurts me. Hurts my head.
Well, I read the article and I had a slightly different take. The way I read the article was it was a female who had voluntarily been exposed herself. And did not know that there was going to be a recording disseminated, and it was disseminated all over the school.
Mm-hmm.
There again, the laws haven't really evolved in some instances to take into account the unique situation. I mean, society would agree that you probably don't want naked images of teenagers floating around, but unless they carved out a particular exception for those that a person sends of themselves that are privately intended as private content for their boyfriend or girlfriend, then the prosecutor, in their desire to put a stop to this outrageous behavior, looks at, well, how can we bring charges? Well, it is against the law to transmit pictures of minors over the internet, and there's not an exception for people who do it. Well, if there's not an exception in the law, it doesn't exist. I mean, prosecutorial discretion. You could say I'm going to choose not to prosecute this, but they have that tool available to them. If you're not happy with that, then you need to get with your people down in Raleigh, and you need to pass a law that carves out an exception for private transmission of images where teenagers are sexting among themselves. If this is offensive to you, do something about it.
The interesting thing about sending stuff over the internet is you might cross state lines, and then that brings you into federal jurisdiction.
Well, arguably, the feds say that anytime you send something that they can't have jurisdiction. I'm not aware of the feds prosecuting teenagers for transmitting it among themselves, but I think this went beyond the transmission between, I think this particular issue was that was being disseminated all over the school, and the girl was not comfortable with everything being distributed to everybody. It was a private showing that she had granted.
Sure. And two-ish, three-ish years ago, there was a big uproar in a pretty affluent area in Colorado where the kids had little vaults on their phones to where they could store the images, and it looked like a calculator app, and they're just sharing pictures of all of each other. There's like 100 people sharing pictures of each other all around the school, and I think that one just went away. I never heard anything beyond that after it came to light. I think they, like, you know, the affluent community, kind of like the Parkland shooting.
There was enough pressure on the prosecutors, right, to stop it. This could be slightly different because this, like I say, was being disseminated. But this is an area where I think you might could get some bipartisan traction, because whether you're conservative or liberal, oftentimes you're going to have offspring, and most people don't want to see their offspring subjected to harsh penalties for juvenile behavior, which allows you to go, whether you're talking to a conservative or liberal, and say, we need to carve out an exception in the statute so that people who are doing this cannot be prosecuted. We don't want to rely on just the good discretion of a prosecutor, because sometimes they don't have good discretion.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that they cannot do what we did. We've got a model for you here at our state. If you have trouble coming up with a model, we've got it where they can't prosecute, and it drives our attorney general crazy. He's just doing all he can to try to change that, because he said we're leaving children vulnerable to exploitation, and then we need to allow that discretion. Well, we've learned that too much discretion is not a good thing when it comes to charging people with criminal conduct.
Sure.
So, as our favorite listener says, we decided to do something about it, and we tied their hands where they can't do it.
And tell me again what you thought about the speaker at the conference and his use of the word "so."
Well, I don't know if you've been able to go through his recording and see how many, but I'd like to hear the tally. It was a great speech, very moving, but he had quite a few "so's." But it's just so easy to say that, and I catch myself all the time trying to be more conscious and stop it.
I do too, and I've noticed myself doing it a lot tonight. So, from the Washington Post, voters remove judge who sentenced Brock Turner to 6 months in Stanford's sexual assault case. The supporters had argued that removing a duly elected judge over disagreement with a controversial but lawful sexual assault sentence would both erode the democratic process and cause judges everywhere to impose lengthier sentences for fear of public backlash. This was the article was, more in condemning the action of removing the lawfully in place judge there in California. And that sentiment is just rings home that now you've subjected judges who should be more nonpartisan, should just be kind of removed from the whole political process in general. But now they're going to be scared to death that there's going to be, as the caller said, mob rule and forcing judges out.
I think we discussed this on last week's podcast.
We did.
Well. Yeah, we talked about this. My fear is that there will be, similar to the DWI monitoring that takes place in various courts around the country, where you have really strong Mothers Against Drunk Driving affiliates, where they have a lot of volunteers that are willing to sit in courtroom and tally judges. My fear is that we're going to have the same thing start happening with sexual crimes. And the 3-year mandatory minimum that has been passed as a result of this in California will become the new, which will cause judges, even for those who are not under this mandatory minimum, because people who are already in the system before the mandatory minimum was passed, their conduct would be under the previous law, which would have allowed for a lesser sentence, like what Brock Turner got. The judge is going to feel compelled to impose at least the minimum, and even they're going to be reluctant on that because that becomes the new benchmark of leniency. Well, he only imposed the minimum sentence. Well, right. Minimum is 3 years, but it was only the minimum.
Yeah, right.
So my fear is we're going to have lengthier sentences across the board, and I don't know how many states have the possibility of removing judges through a process similar to what California. But if there are states that have similar process, you could expect that the victims' advocates will take advantage of that.
And a quote from Judge Persky is, "As a prosecutor, I fought vigorously for victims. As a judge, my role is to consider both sides. California law requires every judge to consider rehabilitation and probation for first-time offenders. It's not always popular, but it's the law. And I took an oath to follow it without regard to public opinion or my opinions as a former prosecutor." This is really problematic, and I don't want to cover it very, very long because we covered it last week. But the article came up, and it was an article talking on the counterpoints of having it removed. So I wanted to bring up those issues.
Well, I have great fear. I think that this is going to do a tremendous amount of damage, and I think that lengthier sentences will be the likely result. And I believe that the public doesn't give a damn. I believe that the average, I mean, it's reflected in the vote. It was 60-40.
Yeah, it was not really very close. Can we cover something real quick? The Supreme Court decision about the Colorado baker. I want to clarify a term real quick. And they said, quote unquote, a narrow decision. And when I first heard it, I was like, 7-2 statistically is not very narrow. Can you clarify that?
I can. The decision, they carefully crafted it to be narrow in its impact, and they ruled on the Civil Rights Commission, or whatever, I forget they called it in Colorado, that it was a procedural. They found bias in the administrative process, and therefore you cannot really infer anything from on the merits of what a baker can or cannot do. You can infer that that particular baker, wasn't treated fair by an agency that was supposed to be impartial, and they had apparently hostility towards his religious views. Narrowness means that decision will apply only to him.
Okay.
When they use a phrase like narrowly decided, a 5-4, which are frequent decisions with the ideological balance we have right now, decisions are oftentimes 5-4, and that would be a narrow decision because one vote would have swayed it the other direction. But in this context, it was the narrowness of the application of their ruling. They worked very hard to make sure they didn't set precedent at this time. They're going to wait for another day.
Got it. So where Packingham has very broad sweeping impact, this has almost zero sweeping impact.
It has impact on that baker alone, and people who want to use that process in Colorado that feel their rights are being violated. That commission will probably be a little more careful about showing open hostility towards a person's religious beliefs. That's the limitation of the ruling. We don't know yet whether you can refuse to provide that service. You can't conclude from that decision that one way or the other which way the court's leaning.
Got it. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. This next article comes from theconversation.com. Are sex offender registries reinforcing inequality? And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up is the author is an assistant professor of sociology at Alabama State University of New York. His name is Trevor Hopp or Hope. I'm not really sure which way I should pronounce his name. The reason, so in the article, he talks about that punishment scholar Jonathan Simon argues that the rise of sex offender registry is the result of lawmakers' efforts to govern through crime. In other words, today's lawmakers assert their authority by enforcing order and promoting fear of crime. This approach differs from, say, politicians who secure authority by promoting a social welfare agenda and social safety net. The article's felt to me just another angle of looking at how the registry is so impactful across different boundaries, and that it is creating a class of people that are impoverished and can never re-enter society. They can never be treated. They can never live past it. They're not a whole person. They're just a monster for perhaps committing one crime.
I agree with, I didn't actually read this article, but I agree with what I'm hearing. But it's not new. We do that in America. Our system is designed to allow us to govern through fear. I mean, we had the McCarthy scare back in the 50s, and there was the Red Scare of all the investigations. And we've been on this terrorist thing. You know, we haven't been attacked for better part of 20 years now. And we create boogeymen.
Yes,
and although crime has been declining precipitously for 25 years, the average person doesn't know that. And I, in fact, did a presentation at a conference a couple of years ago in Atlanta, Georgia, with the statistics from the FBI Bureau of Justice Statistics on the screen. And he said, "Nope, nope, nope."
Lies.
Head exploding. Nope, can't be right. And we like for example, the immigration, and I don't want to get into immigration debate, but we're at the lowest level of illegal entry in modern times. But yet we all this hoopla about securing the border. Well, the border is more secure than it's been in modern history. With the technology and the deployment we have on the border, we have a very secure border compared to where we were 15 years ago.
The funniest thing about that particular subject is another podcast. Trust me, I listen to like 50-something podcasts. But a guy named Malcolm Gladwell, who is an award-winning, I think, New York Times or New Yorker columnist, and he did his podcast is I can't remember the name of it. I'll get to the name here in a second. But the reason why we have such a problem with quote-unquote illegal immigrants is because we have a secure border. The people have come in, and now we've made a situation where they can't leave, so they have to stick around. If we would create some sort of process for them to be green carded and come in, do the work and go home, could go back to their families. They left their families back home. Why don't we let them come and go in a sort of legal process where we could get taxes, etc., and have some documentation on them? They're here illegally because they crossed, and then we closed the door, and now they can't get out.
Well, there's some truth in that, and actually after the recession, after the economic crash of 2008, we had a net exodus. People self-deported because the economy shrank for a period of time, and employment opportunities when construction collapsed. There was a big segment in construction. There was a big segment of undocumented in construction and hospitality and service industries. And when tourism and things collapsed, a lot of those companies, those industries cut back. We had an out migration, but we don't have a serious problem relative to what we had 15 years ago.
Yeah.
In terms of the number of people crossing the border illegally is down dramatically, but the average person doesn't know that. They think that Trump is preventing a tidal wave of illegal entry. And it's not true. Now, we did have a tidal wave in 2014-15 of unaccompanied minors, and I cannot explain the reason for that other than civil unrest in a lot of the countries in Latin America, and people wanted to get their kids to safety. I think that would be normal. If you thought that your life was in danger, you'd at least want to save your kid.
Go someplace where it's not happening.
But, but, But in terms of the overall immigration, we don't have a problem. But my point is to bring it back full circle to this issue of crime. It's easy to frighten people if they don't understand, because people are easily soundbited. Yeah. And if you say certain soundbites, secure the border, that resonates, except for it's actually fairly secure already.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to traverse.
And you can never have a – I tell people, if America – the only reason why people would want to quit coming to America would be if we come such a I don't know if I want to use Trump's term, shithole. But unless we become a shithole, people are not going to want to – unless they don't want to live here, America is always going to be a magnet for people to want to come to. We should be happy about that.
Yeah, we have created a prosperous lifestyle, and this is where they want to come from. All over the world, they choose the United States because we have economic prosperity, we have a great education system, et cetera. Why wouldn't we welcome them?
And they're going to want to come. No matter how much we try to secure the border, they're going to want to come.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. The only way they would stop wanting to come would be if we come, and like I said, I don't want to use his term, but since he's used it, unless we become a shithole country, they're going to want to come here. We're not going to be able to stop that.
The podcast is called Revisionist History by Malcolm Gladwell. Go check out. It's called the episode is General Chapman's Last Stand. It's an interesting episode that'll, you know, flip your brain over on what you think about the immigration issue.
Well, the sex offender registry is not keeping people safer. There's statistically all the evidence that's needed to do to show that. We can't show it hasn't saved one, but we can show statistically it's doing no good, and we can show it's doing immense harm.
Yeah,
we are harming the children of the registrants. We're harming the economic opportunity, the prosperity for the people to be integrated, productive, taxpaying citizens. It's a disaster, but yet it makes people feel good, and it's like I'm saying we're able to cause people to fear things that they really shouldn't fear. We have them fearing an escalating crime rate when crime is going down. We have them fearing terrorism when the terrorists are on the run, and their networks are being dismantled. And we have people fearing sex offenders when most of the fear for sexual offenses comes from within the circle of friends, no stranger danger to speak of. We just have all these fears that are unfounded, and that was my point. I didn't want to really get into an immigration debate.
No, and I'm with you, but going back to this specific article where this guy, the associate professor of a college in New York, is, several studies of registered sex offenders have revealed how registries reinforce class inequality by creating patterned experiences of unemployment, harassment, and homelessness. I'm going to take just the idea that this guy, maybe he knows someone on the registry, but he comes to the registry through honest investigation, through research, whatever, that he sees these people having these problems. What is the cause of it? The cause of it is the registry. Yes, you committed a crime. That's how you found yourself on the registry. However, all of those other things kick in, like you said, with the children, and then how are you supporting yourself? And society as a whole later down the line is going to end up to some degree taking care of you, because if you don't have enough money in retirement to take care of yourself, when you go to the doctor, you're going to need assistance from society as a whole. It seems in our best interest that we would try and elevate as many people up as high as we could as fast as possible to contribute more to the general pool than to be pulling from it.
I agree.
Do you think that people like this author of this article, do you think there's more of it out there now of just average Joes seeing the damage on this side of it, that public opinion will further change and there won't be such this vigilante aspect to it?
I'm seeing more understanding when I network with people. I inevitably run into someone who has a friend or knows someone on the registry, and they say it does gross things and that person doesn't deserve it, but they seem to localize it to that person.
Okay.
They draw a distinction between that person, and they think that the rest of the registry is people who deserve it, but their friend or their acquaintance. I have a lot of difficulty getting to the next level. Is no one deserves this. No one deserves this.
Just like that lady on that conference call we had when I first got involved, that her son wasn't a sex offender.
Yes, that's the attitude. Is yes, I know someone, and he shouldn't be on the list, but the rest of the creepers deserve it. And I'll say unequivocally, no one deserves to have this done to them. If they're this bad, then they shouldn't be out walking the streets.
Yeah.
But once they pay their debt to society, no one deserves this humiliation. I can't help it. If they offend again, we'll lock them up again. But right. Until they offend again, they're allowed to go on with their life and be forgotten.
But is it worth squashing their civil liberties in the thoughts that they might do it again?
Absolutely not. We don't do anticipatory punishment in the United States of America.
I think that's called thought crime, and they do that in the movie Minority Report, which you admittedly have never seen.
We don't do predictive modeling and punish people for something they may do. We punish people for what they have done. And once that punishment is ended, they should be allowed to resume their normal life. And if they offend again, we will punish you again.
Probably with
harsher.
That's the
program. When people ask me, what's the alternative? I tell them it's very simple. We do what we do with all other offenses. When they offend again, we punish again.
And probably get something more severe.
but that's what we do.
This next article comes from the New York Times. Should statutes of limitations for rape be abolished? With the passage of time, memories fade, evidence is lost or destroyed, and witnesses become unreliable or difficult to locate. Since 2002, at least 29 states have amended their prosecution deadlines so victims of child sexual abuse have more time to pursue criminal cases as adults, including 15 states that have now no cutoff for prosecuting any felony sexual assault of a minor, according to Marcy Hamilton. She's one of our super-duper awesome friends. She's the one that debated Emily Horowitz at the, I can't remember what the venue was up in New York City. And the 10 states are listed now have no time limit for filing charges for all or nearly all felony sexual assaults, no matter the victim's age. And I guess one question I have is in regards to DNA evidence is that it only confirms that person A and person B met. It doesn't mean that there was any force or coercion or anything that sort. It confirms that the two were together. But even that, I remember hearing something kind of nefarious where I want to say it was Israel had some sort of way of almost like fabricating DNA, and they could plant DNA someplace where you'd never, ever even considered going. Anyway, and I bring that up just to say that, and we talked about this earlier, I'm not suggesting that there's DNA, there's semen planted in the women's parts, but it is a possible explanation for how it got there. I'm not saying it's at all any sort of prevalence, but it's a possible way it got there. But if there is a rape kit or something, then you have some sort of, you have evidence that an event occurred. So, where am I wrong?
Well, if you're talking about DNA in terms of being in a body cavity, there's DNA that's collected a lot of places or not in a body cavity. But if you had DNA that was in a body cavity, that would be strongly suggestive that the owner of that DNA, the donor of that the owner or donor, however they refer to it, that they've been there. That would be true. But that doesn't mean that they've been there without permission, does it?
No, that was sort of the way that I was trying to explain this in a convoluted way. Right.
But there's DNA in criminal investigations where it's not removed from a cavity. It's removed from proximity. There's proximity DNA. It could be on the person's clothing. And I think I gave the example in episode 3, and I'm pulling that out of air. But if I'm driving across the country, and I pick up someone who's hitchhiking, they're going to get my DNA in all likelihood if they sit in my car that I've been driving for 15 years. Wouldn't you agree?
They're going to pick up my DNA. They're going to pick up skin cells.
Okay, so I've been driving the car for 15 years, and my DNA. And what happens when the next really nice person that picks them up hitchhiking is not so nice? And that person's never been apprehended for a crime, never been charged with a crime. It's not in the system, the DNA database. And the last person's DNA that showed up,
then
what? It doesn't prove that I killed the person.
It proves that you were together at some point.
That's correct. But getting back to the statute of limitations, regardless of the DNA, whether it was a cavity or whether it was a proximity DNA, they're witnesses that we get back to the same part about the statute of limitations. Depending on how much time has passed, any witness could that might possibly explain that stuff may not be available, which makes it only the accuser that gets to participate in the process. Because if anybody who can be of assistance to the accused is not available because 3 decades have passed, is that a fair confrontation?
It is not a fair confrontation. I struggle with this one so hard, Larry, because I've been trying to self-analyze to figure out where my the foundation thought is. And I think in American culture and probably others around the world, as soon as you are accused, you are guilty. It's just you're already done. The DA wouldn't have brought up any sort of indictment or anything unless you were already, there was some level of evidence that says you're guilty. So therefore you're guilty. It's over. Just lay down.
Okay. Well, let's take my hitchhiking. I'm a nice guy, and I pick up the person and I drive them 100 miles up the road, and I stop and I buy them lunch at a cafe or something, and I have a conversation with the owner of the diner, and he or she is 64 years old, and I say I picked up this young lady or young man, whichever the case may be, and I feel bad, but she's trying to get to Toledo, and I'm only going to Little Rock. Can you keep an eye on her? Well, if that young person turns up dead, my DNA is on the person, and the person who would have been able to be affirm my story is long gone. Is that fair to me that I'm accused of murder because my DNA is there because 30 years pass and they finally decide that I'm the one who did it and I was the last person with them, and I can't have my fair trial because the person is gone? Now, murder is an extreme example because the person, in most instances, there is no statute of limitations in most states for murder. But suppose it was a sexual assault that occurred. Suppose that it was unreported sexual assault because the person was so traumatized that they didn't report it. So there was no vaginal collection of DNA. And it was the only evidence that they have was the DNA that was collected from proximity. Well, my DNA is there. The person says that the person who picked him up when they were hitchhiking is the one who assaulted them. Unfortunately, it was the next person who picked him up. Is that fair to me? My witness is dead.
I was thinking about this earlier, and a house that I lived in New Orleans is no longer there. I went there a few years later, and the house had been torn down. So there would be that evidence too.
That's my point. Well, the person who was sexually assaulted is result of hitchhiking. Unfortunately, should have come forward. And there's a lot of things that we pay a price for not doing in our life. And you can't get justice if you don't complain. And if you wait 30 years to complain, my answer is, I'm terribly sorry, but we can't do anything for you at this point because the statute of limitations has run and the person we're going to accuse cannot get a fair trial. And it's not all about you. It's about the fairness that everybody, this system is designed to be fair. And you want to have it where it's only fair to you. And I'm sorry it doesn't work that way. That politically will not get you any points. If you do that, you'll have every Me Too movement. You'll have every victims advocate organization putting out hit pieces on you in the political campaign, and you will cease to hold office, which means what I just said is not going to happen. But that's how I feel about it.
I'm trying to frame it differently, that while the two people involved in prosecuting and defending, as in the victim and the defendant, are the two people that are impacted by the event, that is not what is being on trial. It is the person defending is on trial, but what is at stake, or what is in the game, is the evidence and the proof of the evidence, and the accuser has the burden of proof with beyond a reasonable doubt that it has occurred. Otherwise, you should go home. That the defendant should get out of there. They have to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is a very high level of evidence to prove that the victim had done to them what the defendant is accused of.
Well, the victims somehow get mad when you remind them that if you're the accusing party, you bear the burden, whether it be in a civil proceeding or in a criminal proceeding, to prove it. I didn't make those rules, boys and girls. Those are the rules that our forefathers established, that if the government's going to attempt to put you in a cage, they have to prove by a very high standard called beyond a reasonable doubt that the person engaged in that unlawful behavior. And it's not intended to be victimization of you. It's intended so that we don't put people in cages without very strong evidence. It's very difficult to live your life in a cage, particularly if you don't belong there. Have you ever been in one?
Me personally, yes, I have.
Yeah. Yes. Well, it's an awesome thing to be able to put someone in a cage, in particular if they're not guilty of what they're being accused of.
Yeah, I totally see your point. I'm trying to figure out how to frame it in a way that, the only way that seems to make sense to me at this point is where what is actually I don't know the right words, but the trial, the evidence itself is what is being ruled upon. There is a victim, kind of sort of on both sides, but there's the victim of the crime, and then there's the defendant of the accused crime. But what is happening is the evidence is being brought, and that's what is being judged.
That is correct. The evidence and the person's accusation is evidence. It is one component of the evidentiary trail.
But they're no different than a bloody knife or a rape kit. They are a piece of the evidence.
They are a component of evidence. But the victim's advocates would tell you that they should be the only component of evidence when it comes to a sex crime. That it could be 30, 40, 50, 100 years later. Their most recent line is, justice should not have an expiration date. You'll be hearing that quite a bit going forward. Justice shouldn't have an expiration date. Nice little catchphrase they've got.
Talking points. We've been talking about that lately. What message do you want to put out there?
Talking points. Talking points for our side.
But just in general, just, you know, how do you message? How do you bring up the talking points? What are you trying to focus on? What is your signature issue, or, you know, your couple little taglines? But yeah, that was justice shouldn't have a expiration date. That's catchy.
Well, that's what they're doing, abolishing the statute of limitations, because it's hard when you've got them sitting in committee and the accusers don't have anybody sitting there. We don't have people that can afford to take off work and go sit in the Capitol and wait in a hot room for a bill to be heard and spend day after day there. When the bill is heard, there's the governmental apparatus, which includes the prosecutors, the law enforcement, which includes the district attorneys, the police, the sheriffs. They're all there saying how horrible it is. And there's maybe one liberal do-gooder from the accused side, from the Defenders Association, if they can afford to send somebody, saying, well, whoa, slow down the train here. And it's just very difficult because they're very compelling. You know, they come across very emotionally, and we should get justice. And as the caller pointed out, this is essentially mob rule. that's what this is. If we eradicate all due process, then we've got mob rule. And I feel very uncomfortable where I see us headed, because anybody's going to be able to be accused of anything. And the fact that the accusation, I think our next article is going to get into this a little bit, any accusation is going to be sufficient to put someone away for a long time.
Which brings us up to the article. And we have a couple from the New York Law Journal. This is the first one. This one's kind of fun, though. Bill to create prosecutorial misconduct commission approved by New York State Assembly. The association representing New York State's district attorneys is urging members of the State Assembly to vote against a bill that would create a commission to investigate misconduct by prosecutors. This is the body that is trying to bring charges against people and find the evidence to lock away the bad people. Wouldn't they want to have some sort of commission that helps keep them from doing nefarious things also?
Well, if you were to believe that prosecutors are pure as the wind driven snow and that they always use ethical means to prosecute people, yes, that is exactly what they would want.
Aren't those the people?
Prosecutors are not pure as the wind-driven snow, and they use very questionable tactics, including withholding evidence and dubious search warrants and all sorts of coercive tactics to secure convictions. This is actually the Assembly of New York has already passed this, and I think it's sitting on the governor's desk. I think they have this weird process where this is going to have to go through a constitutional amendment. It has to pass two assemblies. Well, I think it's going to have to pass a second time if I read the article correctly. But this is the State Assembly expressing a desire to fix what they perceive as a problem of prosecutorial misconduct. And the prosecutors saying our current system works, and the assembly saying, well, if it did, we wouldn't be in this predicament where we're having so much misconduct. But the prosecutors are saying that everything's fine with the status quo. And the assembly is saying that everything's not fine. It was a pretty lopsided majority that passed it. It looks like the conservatives were opposed to it, which I'm not surprised. The conservatives are usually in favor of all the police powers against individuals that can be that there can be, unless it has to do with gun rights, and then magically they're against that. But even with conservative opposition, it passed, and you've got a relatively liberal governor with Cuomo, and there's a good chance that he'll sign it. I don't think he's going to succumb to the prosecutor's pressure to veto. I'm not expecting a veto, but I think it has to pass a second time if I read it correctly. And our New York listeners, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong.
Do you think, though, how do you think that this would go into play of finding the actions that were misconducting? It's probably not even a word. But how would you identify the prosecutorial misconduct to begin with? It's not an open panel. It's not the...
Well, the defense attorney would... Well, I mean, most decent defense attorneys know when the prosecutor's engaging in unethical and improper conduct. Sometimes you don't. If they've withheld key evidence and you don't know that they've withheld it, you don't know that.
So then, so during the trial, you find out that they've done something that was...
If you find out later that could be used for setting aside the conviction, but then nothing happens to the prosecutor, and that's what this whole thing is designed to do, is to hold the prosecutor accountable so that there is a penalty. If you engage in misconduct, there is a penalty.
We've talked about this before, that prosecutors face no dereliction of duty punishment. They face no punishment for dereliction of duty of doing those things, or just they hold all the cards almost. They're entirely driving the bus in filling up the jails, in who they're charging with crimes, etc. But there's no oversight of that element. There's no oversight of that body.
I don't know what you mean by that. There's no oversight.
Well, I mean, just like the New York is creating a commission to go look at prosecutorial misconduct. What would the means be in another state to try and handle this?
Well, prosecutors are attorneys, and they're subject to the rules of the discipline of their local bar, of the state bar. What we found is that state bars are usually highly reticent and hesitant to question a prosecutor's decision. They're much more likely to get on the defense attorney for mismanaging their trust account. I know that's certainly in our state. But prosecutors are given such broad discretion because the disciplinary people believe that they're accountable to a higher authority. That's the electing public, which makes them, I mean, I figure a prosecutor wins by a significant margin, and then you have these bunch of do-gooders that are mm-hmm. that are on the disciplinary council come in and remove and neuter a prosecutor, which we talked about on a few episodes back about where a prosecutor was not going to be allowed to prosecute because you remember the case that was on appeal to the higher court. And the prosecutor was without authority because the disciplinary council had suspended him. Do you remember that one?
I do not remember that.
But these existing bodies are very hesitant to neuter a prosecutor because they're elected by the people and they're technically accountable to the people.
Right. But there's not. I guess part of that though is that there's nobody out there, other than when the elections come around again, someone saying, "Hey, this guy did this to this person." There's not some, like, there's media coverage.
Well, try campaigning on that. Try to campaign and say that a prosecutor was go out and say, "I'm running against this guy because he disregarded an accused rights," and find out how many votes that gets you.
That's my point, though. So you don't get a lot of political credit for smearing the guy for not convicting somebody.
Well, beyond the point of not convicting, of saying prosecutor was not abiding by the rules and they were trampling the accused rights. Find out how well, go out and take a poll in your area and find out how many people care about that.
So you need some sort of independent body to then go investigate those outside of the scope of the political ramifications.
And that's exactly what the Assembly of New York is trying to create with this commission.
Which goes back to my question of how many states then do this sort of thing.
Well, as far as I know, this is the first.
Right. That was God. That was a long way to get around to that.
But you can file with existing framework. You can file a complaint on a prosecutor with the disciplinary council in your state, and they have the authority. But I'm just saying they're hesitant to use that authority because the person is elected.
And there was something in Georgia. There was a 3-person commission, and that got squashed a handful of election cycles ago. I can't remember what it was called, but it was something along those lines. I think that was related to judges, though, not necessarily prosecutors. I can't remember what that was. Let's move on. Really, this is the last article. Then we have like what we're going to talk about. So this is also from the New York Law Journal. What is clear and convincing evidence in sex offender registration? SORA. What is the A in SORA? Sex offender registration A. SORA hearings. And this is by Lorca Morello, has been an appellate attorney for more than 20 years and has litigated SORA hearings. A teenager testified that when she was 11 years old, she had sexual intercourse with her uncle during a visit to her grandmother. Her uncle and grandmother testified that no such thing had occurred. The people presented an expert to explain why the girl showed no physical signs of having sexual intercourse, and another expert to explain why she waited so long before saying anything. Statute of limitations. The jury nevertheless rejected her story and acquitted the uncle of felony charges. But in an apparent something must have happened compromise, they returned a guilty verdict of the misdemeanor of mouth-to-breast contact. I've never heard of such a thing. It's kind of silly sounding. A correct point assessment based on Britain's misdemeanor conviction and lack of criminal history would have put him on the lowest risk level. The people argued, however, that he should be scored additional points for the offenses of which he was acquitted, thereby elevating his classification from low to moderate and putting him on the Internet Sex Offender Registry for life. Although the only evidence that sexual intercourse occurred was testimony expressly rejected by the jury, the appellate division held that it met the clear and convincing standard. To be clear and convincing, the evidence must be a firm belief or conviction of the truth of the allegations. By being so clear, direct, and weighty and convincing as to enable the fact finder to come to a clear conviction without hesitancy of the truth of the precise facts at issue. That is some garbly-gook language right there. It is deeply troubling that the Court of Appeals has upheld the inflating of a person's risk level based on discredited testimony. Unlike many jurisdictions that simply correlate sex offenders' future risk level to the offense of conviction, New York requires an individualized judicial determination. As Rivera stated... Rivera stated, the SORA statute holds the people to the high and clear and convincing evidence burden for the very reason that a defendant's liberty interest is at stake, and the risk level determination has severe consequences. But a judicial determination is meaningless if courts jettison basic evidentiary principles. Sorry that I had to read all that. But there's a lot going on there as far as that the person was acquitted of the actual alleged crimes, but they...
The serious crime. They, right. They were convicted of a lesser crime, and that was a sexual crime.
And you want to bring this up because of risk, the risk assessment method.
Well, this is the podcast is designed to educate people. And there are people who believe that a risk system is the cure-all, end-all to all problems. And this is an example of where I think we had this on a previous podcast of a similar case where there was a conviction of some sort. The conviction of the mouth-to-breast contact was enough hanging with them to need to be risk assessed. The other case was that the guy was going to have to incriminate himself while he was appealing the low-level conviction. But this brought him within the risk assessment process. And I don't know verbatim what the risk assessment looks like in New York, but I know that they can take into account your sexual proclivities. And the fact that the jury did not believe and convict does not mean that didn't happen. That's not a finding of innocence. It's a finding of not guilty. And those are two different things. They didn't pronounce him innocent. They pronounced the state deficient in its evidence that it presented. Now, according to the Vickets, that would have been enough because she said it happened. But they didn't find it convincing. Therefore, they refused to convict on the serious charges. But he was convicted of a sex offense. He was required to go through a registration evaluation for his registry leveling, and he went through that. And the trial court, which is the same court that conducted the trial of the case in chief of the charges, that they believed her, that it was a lesser standard, it was not beyond a reasonable doubt. So the trial judge said, under the lesser standard, I believe that he did this offense. Therefore, he gets extra points. Constitutionally, there's nothing flawed about that decision. You may not like it, but that's the way it is. I know you hate that, but that was within the zone of when appellate courts look at evidence and sufficiency of evidence, which is what the question of this, whether there was sufficient evidence to merit the risk level that they had given, they are very hesitant to overturn the trial judge who sat there and heard the evidence. The trier of fact is believed to be best capable of evaluating the nuances of the evidence, the credibility of the witness, and make a determination of whether that evidence is believable. And therefore, they went into this looking at it as an appellate tribunal of trying to uphold the trial judge. The trial judge found her evidence credible enough under the lesser evidentiary standard to believe that he committed that crime. Therefore, he gets the points. End of discussion.
That almost sounds like what we talked about before of thought crime. Maybe it doesn't, because they found that something happened, just not necessarily everything that she had alleged. But what would be the review process to figure out what level he should be at? Not just that there was something.
It was a sex crime happened. He put his mouth on her breast. That's what they found.
And do you think he went through like a psychosexual eval?
Well, that's what the judge was doing. The judge, I mean, I don't know if he had, I would imagine that any court that's going to do a risk leveling would require that.
Okay.
But the judge had the prerogative to believe that accuser, because the standard of evidence is not beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard of evidence is clear and convincing, which is one notch below that.
Okay.
That's what's consternating people. The jury didn't find him innocent. They found him not guilty. They said, prosecutor, you didn't give us enough evidence to believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he did that. Therefore, we're going to do our duty and find him not guilty. But they didn't find him innocent.
And then through the additional process of the review board, they found him
the risk assessment determination, which is what the judge decided. The judge apparently does the risk determination in New York, but I don't think he just arbitrarily did it. I would hope that there was a risk assessment done. But the prosecutor got to come in and argue that you should consider this, and the judge agreed. The judge found that I find her testimony credible and convincing. Therefore, I'm giving him points for that. There's nothing structurally wrong with that.
A firm belief or conviction of the truth of the allegations.
And the judge says he has a firm belief of the truth of the allegations.
I'm trying to unpack those words and comprehend them, digest them. That's what I'm trying to get
into
my brain.
Well, and the judge firmly believes that he did the crime. It's an O.J. Simpson thing. The jury found him not guilty. The civil jury came in with a lesser evidentiary standard and said, you killed Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson.
Right. Interesting. And that would be a drawback of the risk assessment side. So the other side of that is, here's the crime you were convicted of. If they only went by that, then he would have been evaluated at the lowest level. Where
if that were the case. But see, that's people wanting to have it both ways.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I always try to be intellectually honest. If you want to have it both ways, then you have to be honest that, hey, I want to have a risk assessment when it suits my purposes, and then I want to tie the state's hands. So maybe you have a hybrid model. You say if it's a misdemeanor conviction, then we don't get to consider anything else. But right now, it doesn't matter what's a misdemeanor conviction. They get to consider your sexual proclivities and the evidence that would suggest that you're higher risk. And they considered the evidence that he actually did the full gamut, even though he wasn't convicted. And they gave him points for that.
All right. The final thing is, there's this I'm just going to call him a knucklehead. There's a politician in Pennsylvania, and his name is Tom Mahaffey, maybe? And he has decided that he wants to propose a 5,000-foot living restriction for those people on the registry. This doesn't necessarily mean you were convicted last year. This could mean that you were convicted in 1970, and you're going to have a 5,000-foot. That is a gigantic circle that where you wouldn't be able to live. So what we wanted to then try and unpack would be, if this was your state, how you would possibly go about challenging this to bring to gum it up, to prevent it, to however we're going to negotiate this process to keep this thing from happening. This is just we're going to assume it's a proposed bill, and Larry, being the expert at gumming up, making things worse, have at it.
Well, since it's Pennsylvania, their process is different. They have longer sessions. So the techniques that I use here would not be completely applicable, because I've got time on my side. And if you have long year-round or very long sessions, time doesn't work to your advantage the way it does here.
Okay.
Time is my friend. You've got a very limited amount of it, and you've got a lot of hurdles. And I'm going to try to give you as many hurdles as I can when you have a bad bill so that we run out the clock. But what I would do, if I were in a state that had a longer session where time is not as much of an ally as it is for us, I would get to know my leadership. I would make sure I knew the majority leader of the Senate and the majority leader of the House. I'd make sure I knew the majority whip and the of the House and the majority. The leaders are key. And I would make sure I was good friends with the committee chairs that legislation is typically assigned to. And I would make sure that I was good friends with the analysts. There's usually a team of analysts, depending on the size of the assembly. But I would get to know, if you're in Pennsylvania and it's going to go to the House Judiciary Committee, I would try to find out who the analysts are. And I would make sure that I provide them all the evidence I could about the efficacy of residency restrictions and the actual adverse consequences of states like Iowa that have pulled back from them. And I would make sure the analysts get good information. And I would talk to committee chairs or their staffers in the larger states where you may have more access problems. The access I take for granted in a small state like New Mexico would be much more difficult than California, be a lot more difficult in New York. Pennsylvania is not a gigantic state. You could probably have some reasonable access in Pennsylvania, but I would make sure that I got to be friends with committee chairs, and I would go with them without emotion. Take your emotion and leave it at home, and go with them with, this is bad public policy, and give them two or no more than three reasons why, and leave your binder of exhibits and videos and all that stuff alone and at home, and tell them why this is bad public policy. And if you can get them to derail this and slow it down, there's a variety of techniques that you can use to keep bad legislation from moving. But that's what I would do, is to try to keep it from ever moving and seeing the light of day. And I'd spend absolutely no time with that representative. He's not doing this for rational reasons. He's doing this for political reasons. He may be in a heated reelection campaign. He may perceive that he needs to shave off a half a point or a point. And you can usually shave off a half a point or a point in a close race by doing something nutty, because there are people who respond favorably to nutty stuff. And
based on the current administration,
he may feel like in a close race, and it's hard to know exactly where you are in a legislative race, because the polling data is just not out there.
Sure.
You have to do it internally. You have to commission and pay for it yourself, and you have to try to figure out where you are. But if he perceives that he's in a tough reelection campaign, he may be trying to shave off a point or two to get to the finish line. And he may very well know that this is not going to go anywhere. He may know that it's so absurd, but it may be enough to get where he may have an agenda. And like I say, people are responding to it. People are responding to it in his district. It may be that he's getting more favorable response than negative.
He's in place since 2017. So he's been there for something of a year, 18 months.
He's in his first term, and he's up for re-election. Apparently, he's got a two-year term, and he's up for re-election.
One of the points, so the article that I'm reading, I think, is almost like it's almost like the bill proposal, the way it's written. It says, statistics overwhelmingly show that people who commit sex crimes against children do not respond well to treatment programs and will likely continue to offend. Perpetrators of these crimes must not be permitted to roam freely near children. The risk is too great. How do you deal with that particular statement right off the bat?
It's tough because it's emotion. I mean, you heard Ron Book say it on one of the clips you played that he said it was a no-brainer that people should be kept away from children if they committed a sex offense. You remember that
I clip? Do, absolutely.
Yeah, it's very tough because intuitively people think that they know. It just makes sense that sex crimes to the average person is a child molester if you're on the sex offender registry. Mm-hmm. So clearly, if you're a child molester, you should be kept away from children. I mean, it's very rational to the average person.
Which goes to the rational basis test.
If you say so.
Well, I mean, you just said it's a rational statement. Okay, I mean, I guess that makes sense. So that passes the rational basis test.
Yes, it does. The fact that you want to keep the community safe is rational.
But as Jim DeFede, I think is his name, he said, show me the study, give me the evidence of the study. I talked to Gail Coletta at the conference, and they totally prepped him for that interview with him, and the Florida Action Committee had pushed all of their evidence of the low recidivism rate and all that, so that he had evidence on his side to back up the argument where Ron Book has no evidence. And again, this guy is just making the statement saying that they don't do well with treatment and they're just likely going to reoffend again. But that's not what the evidence shows. So then do you then give your the people that you just spoke about, the whip and the researchers and all that stuff, do you give them the evidence that says contrary to what Knucklehead here is saying?
That's more of a part of thing for an analyst to have in their report. The analyst is going to be best suited for getting those reams of statistics. Even they don't want reams of statistics. You're gonna win this if you win it by other means of communication, which would be it's just so ridiculously absurd that nobody'd be able to live anywhere. That's a mile. 5,000 feet is
it
just
is.
Shy of a mile.
It is. Yes.
You would make everybody a nomad.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you plotted it out across the state, do you make it effective statewide banishment? 5,000 feet is ginormous.
Well, it would be urban banishment altogether, practically.
Yeah, it would be for sure. Yeah, you'd be living in the hills of Pennsylvania.
And should be able to get some conservatives to support you on that. They wouldn't want all the urban people coming out to the rural areas.
And then, like we covered an article where the 18 sex offenders moved in overnight, then those people would be bitching because, like, oh my God, they snuck them in here at the cover of darkness.
Yes, I remember that.
Another point is my legislation would prohibit Megan's Law registrants from residing within 5,000 feet of any public school, private school, parochial school, or preschool. Same thing.
Same thing.
It's just, I can't even, at least it doesn't say, I mean, schools are not nearly as prevalent as churches. Every time I think about this being in Georgia, there's a church everywhere. You're out in the middle of nowhere and all of a sudden there's this little freaking tent somewhere or a single wide trailer and it's the local church. So you couldn't live near there. Currently under Pennsylvania law, there's no residency restriction for sexual offenders other than the requirement to notify the school district that a sexual predator resides within a 1 mile radius. So in Pennsylvania, you only have to tell them that you're in the area, but they can't prevent you from living there. 5,000 feet is huge.
It is scary that in this day of people knowing better that Mr. Mahaffey is out there pushing bad public policy that will actually have support. It'll have a fair amount of support.
Certainly.
Hopefully not enough, but there'll be people who will sign on to this.
I don't know. He is in the 106th district. I don't know. I saw the town that he's in. I'm not really sure that it doesn't resonate with me. It's not a widely named area. You know, it's not like he's in Pittsburgh or he's in Philadelphia. It's nothing. He's not in one of those areas for sure. But I mean, if he gets co-supporters, co-sponsors, and they pass it and the governor signs it, it's a done deal. Then Then this,
I would be very surprised if he can move this through the assembly there. I would be, even though they're under conservative domination, I don't see him getting this through the assembly, although he'll have support.
So it's House Bill 1952. You think that he'll have supporters, but you don't think it'll go through?
I don't see him passing a 1 mile prohibition. I wouldn't advise the people in Pennsylvania to sit on their laurels and hope for the best. But I just don't see that there's got to be more sanity in Pennsylvania than that. And if it made it to Wolf's desk, I would see a probability of a veto. I usually don't predict vetoes, but I think him being more urban oriented, he would see the pitfalls of the people not would have nowhere to live.
Right, but and if they made it retro, then you're making people that committed their crime in 1970 move 5,000 feet away, and you have an ex post facto claim, right?
Yeah, and that I don't think they would make it retro.
So it would only be from this day forward.
Yes.
God.
So I'm looking at the district profile. It's 83% white, 7.8% black.
Where is it?
Conewago Township, Township.
I saw that. That's why it didn't resonate as meaning anything to me.
Yeah, none of these towns make any. Royalton, Lower, Sotero, and Sotero is part of Sotero Township. All these names I'm butchering. I apologize. I just never.
It's a bunch of Native American names up that way.
Yeah, they've had, as far back as I can see, since this district's been created, it's been under Republican, since 1969, it's only had a Republican holding the office, so it tells me it's a conservative area.
To circle back around to cover a frequent question of people, this is not part of AWA, this is not part of Megan's Law, this is not part of any of those things. This is totally this guy expanding out and going beyond the call of duty of what is federally required as a minimum standard, which, and I mean, should be, I should say, federally suggested as a minimum standard.
That is correct. And I'm looking at his election. He didn't even have an opponent in the last election, 2016.
So he just won by default. He showed up and he
won.
100%,
he got 100% of the vote. But the last time there was a contest was in 2012. And the Democrat got 64.77. You might as well say 65% of the vote. I mean, the Republican got 65% of the vote, and the Democrat got 35% of the vote.
That's a pretty much a landslide.
So it's a Republican leaning district. So you guys that are conservative in our audience, which a significant number are, call up Mr. Mahaffey and tell him he's wrong. You live in his district. Tell him that this is not what you want.
But there are only four people that live in his district.
Well, no, actually not. He got 21,900 votes.
Okay, so there's 21,000 people that live there.
And the population of the district is 64,000 people.
Wow, that's
and
small.
The voting age population is 49,000.
Wow, okay. So there are no schools there then. All right.
Well, I think in a district with 50,000, there'd be quite a few schools.
I thought you said the voting.
65,000.
You said
the voting age population is 49,000. The total population is 65,000.
Yeah, so 15,000 perhaps going to school, but that's also like 0 to 6 year olds that haven't really started school yet, too.
So do you think there's 15,000 school children in a population of 65,000?
I'm doing that backwards. Of 65,000 total, 50,000 voters, the rest would be school kids, right? Under 18?
Well, no, everybody that's living there is not a voting age, but so you're extrapolating that the 15,000 that are not voting age would be in school, right?
I'm saying that they're under 18, so they're likely school age ish.
So okay, I see how you get there.
All and right. Then so under six, so take out another third of that, so now you've got 10,000 that are school age. So that's not a huge school population, I don't think. Anyway, that's a crazy weird tangent to go on. And I'm just being silly and picking on that particular area of Pennsylvania.
Well, like I say, it's in South Central PA, and I can't pronounce the townships. But even if you live close by the district, call him and tell him this doesn't represent us.
Right.
Let their phone ring and let them hear opposition. They never hear opposition. The only time his phone is ringing right now is people who saw this in the news and on the television and in the papers, and they're for it. And they're saying, way to go, attaboy.
Well, we've got to get out of here. We're almost at we're about hour and 50 minutes. Do you have anything else?
How do people contact us if they would like to reach us?
Please, pretty please, pretty please, sign up for email notifications if you need them. Go to registrymatters.co. A form's going to pop up. Put in your email address. You'll get notified when a new episode comes out. You could get you could subscribe using a podcast app. Like, you know, I use Dogcatcher on my Android phone. Sign up at Registry Matters. You can they'll just show up on your phone. Or let's see what else. You can find us on YouTube. You could email us registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Phone number 747-227-4477, and follow us on Twitter, Registry Matters on Twitter. I think that's everything.
And our audience is growing every week, isn't it?
We have an international audience. How about that?
Somebody, what country?
It was England.
Well, welcome aboard from across the pond.
Across the pond. Yep. She was following an article from Guy Hamilton Smith, who is very prolific on Twitter, and she found us through that. So that is pretty awesome. Welcome.
And we really appreciate the phone call messages you see. You leave them, and we play them.
Yep, and they're fun. They're interesting aspects to answer your questions.
So
have a great night, Larry. I'll talk to you soon.
Good night. Thanks, Andy.
Bye.